Topic 66, Guidance 1. The problem of guidance is a difficult one to handle, for it is based on an innate instinctive recognition of the fact of God and of God's plan. This inherent instinctual spiritual reaction is being exploited today by many well-meaning reformers who have, however, given no real attention to the subject or to the phenomena of the outer response to a subjective urge. They are, in the majority of cases, blind leaders of the blind. We might define the problem of guidance as the problem of the method whereby a man, through processes of autosuggestion, throws himself into a state of negativity, and while in that state, becomes aware of inclinations, urges, voices, clearly impressed commands, revelations of courses of conduct which should be pursued, or of careers which should be followed, plus a general indication of lines of activity which, quote, God, unquote, is proposing to the attentive, negative, receptive subject. But in any case, the source of the direction and the origin of the guidance is vaguely called, quote, unquote, God, is regarded as divine, is spoken of as the voice of the, quote, Christ within, unquote, or as spiritual direction. Many analogous terms are used according to the school of thought to which the man may belong, or which has succeeded in attracting his attention. We shall see this tendency towards subjective guidance of some kind or another developing increasingly as humanity becomes more subjectively oriented, more definitely aware of the realms of inner being, and more inclined towards the world of meaning. It is for this reason that I desire to make a relatively careful analysis of the possible sources of guidance, so that at least men may know that the whole subject is vaster and more complicated than they had thought, and that it would be the part of wisdom to ascertain the origin of the guidance, and so know the direction in which we are headed. Forget not that the blind, unreasoning subjecting of oneself to guidance, as at present practiced, renders a man eventually a negative, impressionable automaton. Should this become universally prevalent, and the present methods become established habits, the race would forfeit its most divine possession, its free will. There is no immediate fear of this, however, if the intelligent men and women of the world think this problem out. Also, there are too many egos of advanced nature coming into incarnation at this time to permit the danger to grow out of all bounds, and there are too many disciples in the world today whose voices are ringing loudly and clearly along the line of free choice and the intelligent comprehension of God's plan. The emotionally inclined people in the churches of all denominations and persuasions are ever prone to find a way of escape from the troubles and difficulties of life by living always with a sense of the guiding presence of God, coupled to a blind acquiescence in what is generalized as the will of God. The practice of the presence of God is most definitely a desirable and needed step, but people should understand what it means and steadily change the sense of duality into the sense of identification. The will of God can take the form of the imposition of life circumstance and conditions from which there is no escape. The subject of this imposition accepts it and does literally nothing to improve or truly better and perhaps avoid the circumstances. Their destiny and situation is interpreted by them as such, that within the imposed ring pass not and lines of limitation, they determine placidly, submissively to live. A spirit of submission and acquiescence is inevitably developed, and by calling the situation in which they find themselves an expression of God's will, they are enabled to bear it all. In some of the more sublimated states of this acquiescence, the sensitively inclined person voices his submission, but fails to recognize that the voice is his own. He regards it as God's voice. For them, the way of understanding, the recognition of the great law of cause and effect working out from life to life, and the interpretation of the problem in terms of a lesson mastered would spell release from negativity and blind, unintelligent acceptance. Life does not demand acquiescence and acceptance. It demands activity, the separation of the good and high values from the undesirable, the cultivation of that spirit of fight, which will produce organization, understanding, and eventual emergence into a realm of useful spiritual activity. People who participate in the activity of those schools of thought, which are called by many names, such as mental science schools, new thought groups, Christian Science, and other similar bodies, are also prone to drift into a state of negativity based on autosuggestion. The constant reiteration of the voiced but unrealized fact of divinity will eventually evoke a response from the form side of life, which, even if it is not worded guidance, is nevertheless the recognition of a form of guidance and leaves no scope for free will. This is a reaction on a large scale from the one dealt with above. Whereas in the one case there is found a blind acceptance of an undesirable lot because it is the will of God, and that will, therefore, must be good and right. In the second group, there is an attempt to stir the subjective man into the acceptance of a definitely opposite condition. He is taught that there are no wrong conditions except as he himself creates them, that there is no pain and nothing undesirable. He is urged to recognize that he is divine and the heir of the ages, and that the wrong conditions, limited circumstances, and unhappy occurrences are the result of his own creative imagination. He is told they are really non-existent. Of the two schools of thought, the truth about destiny as it works out under the law of cause and effect, and the truth about man's innate divinity are taught and emphasized. But in both cases, the man himself is a negative subject, and the victim either of a cruel fate or of his own divinity. I am wording this with deliberation because I am anxious for my readers to realize that destiny never intended man to be a helpless victim of circumstance or the self-hypnotized tool of an affirmed but undeveloped divinity. Man is intended to be the intelligent arbiter of his own destiny and a conscious exponent of his own innate divinity, of the God within. This is a continuation of topic 66, guidance. Again, schools of esotericists, theosophists, and Rosicrucians, particularly in their inner schools, have also their own forms of this illusion of guidance. It is of a different nature to the two dealt with above, but the results are nevertheless of much the same quality, and reduce the student to a condition of being guided, often of being directed by illusionary voices. Frequently, the heads of the organization claim to be in direct communication with a master or the entire hierarchy of masters from whom orders come. These orders are passed on to the rank and file of the membership of the organization, and prompt, unquestioning obedience is expected of them. Under the system of training, imparted under the name of esoteric development, the goal of a similar relationship to the master or hierarchy is held out as an inducement to work or to meditation practice, and someday the aspirant is led to believe that he will hear his master's voice, giving him guidance, telling him what to do, and outlining to him his participation in various roles. Much of the psychological difficulties found in esoteric groups can be traced to this attitude and to the holding out to the neophyte of this glamorous hope. In view of this, I cannot too strongly reiterate the following facts. 1. That the goal of all teaching given in the real esoteric schools is to put man consciously in touch with his own soul and not with the master. 2. That the master and the hierarchy of masters work only on the plane of the soul, as souls with souls. 3. The conscious response to hierarchical impression and to the hierarchical plan is dependent upon the sensitive reaction which can be developed and made permanent between a man's own soul and his brain via his mind. 4. That the following points should be borne in mind. A. When a man is consciously aware of himself as a soul, he can then be in touch with other souls. When he is consciously a disciple, he is then in touch with and can collaborate intelligently with other disciples. C. When he is an initiate, other initiates become facts in his life and consciousness. D. When he is a master, the freedom of the kingdom of heaven is his, and he works consciously as one of the senior members of the hierarchy. But, and this is of prime importance, all of these differentiations relate to grades of work and not to grades of persons. They indicate soul expansions, but not graded contacts with personalities. According to the realized soul development upon the physical plane will be the response to the world of souls of which the occult hierarchy is the heart and mind. The guidance to which the adherents of many esoteric schools so often respond is not that of the hierarchy, but that of the astral reflection of the hierarchy. They respond, therefore, to an illusory, distorted, man-made presentation of a great spiritual fact. They could, if they so chose, respond to the reality. Mystics of all kinds, with a natural predisposition to the introspective, negative life, are today hearing voices, receiving guidance, and obeying impulses which they claim come from God. Groups everywhere are occupied with the task of orienting people to the spiritual life, or with the task of ascertaining the plan of God, or of cooperating with it in some way or other. Some of these works are working intelligently and are sometimes correct in their surmises and endeavors, but the bulk of them are incorrect, as they are largely astral in nature. Therefore, it is of real value to us to study the sources from which much of this so-called, quote, guidance, unquote, can come. For the sake of clarity and impressiveness, I propose to list these sources very briefly and without any prolonged comment. This will give the earnest and intelligent investigator the opportunity to realize that the whole theme is vaster and far more important than has been surmised, and may lead to a more careful analysis of the, quote, types of guidance, unquote, and an understanding of the possible directing agencies to which the poor and ignorant neophyte may fall a victim. 1. Guidance or instruction coming from the man or woman upon the physical plane to whom the guided person is, usually unconsciously, looking for help. 2. The introverted attitude of the neophyte or mystic brings to the surface all his subconscious, quote, wish life, unquote. These, however, he interprets in terms of definite extraneous guidance and formulates them to himself in such a way that they become to him the voice of God. 3. The recovery of old spiritual aspirations and tendencies coming from a previous life or lives. They appear to him as utterly new and phenomenal, and he regards them as divine injunctions coming from God. 4. The, quote, guidance, unquote, registered, can also be simply a sensitivity to the voices and injunctions and well-meaning intentions of good people on the path of return to incarnation. The spiritual dilemma of the race today is causing the rapid return of many advanced souls to life on the physical plane, as they hover on the borderland of outer living, awaiting their time to be reborn. They are oft contacted subjectively and unconsciously by human beings in incarnation, particularly at night when the consciousness is out of the physical body. What they say and teach, frequently good, usually indifferent in quality, and sometimes quite ignorant, is remembered in the waking hours of consciousness and interpreted by the neophyte as the voice of God giving guidance. 5. The guidance can also be of an astral, emotional nature and is the result of the contacts made by the aspirant upon the astral plane. They are all colored by glamour, and many well-meaning leaders of groups and organizations get their inspiration from these sources. There is in them no true lasting divine guidance. 6. The guidance recorded may also be the result of the man tuning in telepathically upon the mind or the minds of others. 7. The mental world, as well as the astral world, is full of thought forms, and these can be contacted by man and be interpreted by him as conveying guidance. 8. Guidance can come, therefore, from all kinds and types of incarnate or disincarnate men, ranging in character from very good to very bad. They include the help proffered by real initiates and adepts through their working disciples and aspirants to the mental and astral activities of ordinary intelligent men and women, including the emotionally and selfishly oriented person. It should be remembered that no true initiate or disciple ever seeks to control any person, nor will he indicate to him in the form of positive command any action which he should take. 9. Guidance also comes from a man's own powerful, integrated personality, and he will frequently fail to recognize it for what it is. 10. Guidance can come, as you well know, from a man's own soul, when, through meditation, discipline, and service, he has established contact, and there is consequently a direct channel of communication from soul to brain via the mind. This, when clear and direct, is true divine guidance, coming from the inner divinity. It can, however, be distorted and misinterpreted if the mind is not developed, the character is not purified, and the man is not free from undue personality control. The mind must make right application of the imparted truth or guidance. Where there is true and right apprehension of the inner divine voice, then, and only then, do you have infallible guidance, and the voice of the inner God can then speak with clarity to its instrument, man upon the physical plane. 11. Once this latter form of guidance has been established, stabilized, fostered, developed, and understood, other forms of spiritual guidance then become possible. From A Treatise on the Seven Rays, Volume 2, Esoteric Psychology 2, pages 480 through 492. 2. A neophyte in an ashram is under the guidance of a more advanced chela, and the master is receiving regular reports based on certain charts from the senior disciple who has the neophyte in his charge. From Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, page 11.